on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of July 24th, 2016. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor for Technical Content at Information Week, and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. Have a great episode lined up for you this week. It's me and one of my colleagues, and well, it's a colleague we don't get to have on the show nearly as much as we'd like, so we're grateful to have her today. We have Jessica here. Jessica, coming in from Pittsburgh, PA. How are you this lovely day?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm actually in Philadelphia, so the suburbs of Philadelphia.
So dealing with
staying away from the city this week, though, in the wake of the big convention downtown.
I apologize, Jessica. I was trying to get you as far away from the convention as I could while remaining within the state of Pennsylvania.
Well, thank you for that.
So I've got to ask, are you far enough away from all of the hoo-ha downtown to be more or less unaffected by it?
As long as I don't need to travel into the city, I'm all set at this point in time. I have actually heard some very big aircraft overhead, which is not typical. So the flight patterns must have changed due to security or weather. Not really sure. But, yeah, big excitement here. And actually, our public transportation system has had an issue recently where about half of the commuter trains have been recalled. So the fleet is cut in half, and so public transportation is difficult right now, too, at a very bad time. But
it does sound like it so far. But I'm sure, given its reputation, that the city of brotherly love is responding in its normal, calm, even-tempered fashion with no ill feeling toward anyone.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. And yes, that's what we are, the city of brotherly love. And you know where you stand with Philadelphians. You know, they don't, there's no passive-aggressive sentiment.
No, it's pretty much aggressive in
yeah,
Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, I do applaud everyone that I've heard in the news, you know, avoiding the really big topics that can get you in trouble in Philadelphia. I haven't heard anybody talking about whose cheesesteak is the best, and so far we've had absolutely no mention of the Dallas Cowboys. So, you know, I think that between those two things, you know, the media has done what it could to maintain the peace.
That's good. And it seems to have mostly worked. So it's all good.
Very good news. Well, you know, Jessica, let's switch our focus a little bit, because in addition to the big happenings in Philadelphia this week, there was a pretty big acquisition in the world of enterprise IT, Oracle making a move. I know you've been covering that. Tell us about this purchase that Oracle has made.
Yeah, so pretty exciting news this week, although some people would say it's not such a big surprise. Oracle said it would acquire NetSuite for $9.3 billion. And NetSuite, of course, provides ERP software as a service in the cloud. And Oracle provides that same kind of software, but on premises. And it's been trying to get into the cloud business as well and has made some strides with some revenue increases for its software as a service and platform as a service offerings along the ERP lines. And Oracle made a big statement about how it's going to be the way for enterprises forward to get into the cloud, because they could have the same software that they had on premises in the cloud. There wouldn't be features missing one way or another. Now, with this NetSuite acquisition, you have some overlap in the product lines. And so it's not immediately clear how Oracle will address that overlap. They say that they're planning to continue full development, all the product lines of both companies after the acquisition, and full support of all the product lines. So it'll be interesting to see how the product roadmaps play out going forward. I did reach out to Oracle to ask about that, and they said they had no further comment at this time about the product overlap. So that's where they are with that.
Well, now, this seems to be a little bit of a trend in the industry, doesn't it? I mean, this is something similar to a direction that, for example, SAP has taken with some of their acquisitions.
Yeah, certainly. And you're an expert on SAP, Kurt, being down there in the Florida area where they have so many of their events and a frequent attendee of the Sapphire Conference. SAP has also been pushing their cloud story very hard and has also seen revenue increases on their cloud services. What are some of the cloud acquisitions that really stand out for you for SAP?
Well, to me, one of the really big ones, of course, is SuccessFactors, which is their ERP side of things. That has been a huge, huge role for piece for them. And in addition, they have really in the last, we'll call it 18 to 24 months, been pushing the whole S/4HANA in the cloud story, especially as a way to get customers into the whole S/4HANA ecosystem without having to write an eight-figure check just to get started. Because I think SAP has become sensitive to the fact that, you know, they are an expensive piece of software. There's no way around that. And if you have to add to that the hardware required to run a larger instance of HANA, the price tag can roll up really quickly. So, you know, I think that between the S/4HANA Cloud and SuccessFactors, we've heard a lot of cloud talk from SAP in the last couple of years. And as you say, it's really had a significant impact on their bottom line, because if you take away the cloud portion in the last few quarters, their financial picture gets much sketchier, I think.
Definitely, cloud is the growth area. If you look at any of those traditional players, right? Software license sales have really been stagnant or fallen, while the cloud sales are growing at double digit clips for all these companies. But then at the same time, the biggest piece of the pie of revenues is still the software licenses. So even though they're not growing, you can't really yank the rug out of it right yet, because so much of the business is dependent on it. Kind of puts these companies in a rough position. It's funny too, last fall around Oracle Open World, I spoke with the president, I think, of the Oracle Users Group, who told me that really her company, and she worked for the parent company that owns Amway, the consumer products company, retailer, that they're not in any huge rush to move their workloads and really the infrastructure that they run their business on into the cloud. They were pretty happy with their on-premises solution and didn't see didn't really even have that on their roadmap to move to the cloud. So I think there are still some customers who are really holding back. They have those sunk costs in their enterprise architecture, in their enterprise applications, that they expect to last for a long time. Like you said, they a lot of the costs are huge for some of these systems. And they were not anxious to move off them anytime soon. So I thought that was kind of an interesting perspective, an alternate perspective. We talk a lot about how everyone's moving to the cloud, but certainly it's really not everyone, not yet. There are some people who aren't ready yet, some customers who aren't ready.
Well, I think it's interesting because, as you say, there are companies that aren't ready because, you know, it's a lot of companies have their hardware on a cycle, and for many companies that cycle has to do with things like residual values at the end of leases and all of that. So it may be
right
that from an accounting standpoint, they're not ready to change. But I think a lot of us forget in this world in which we're used to weekly updates on our smartphones and at the most monthly updates on our laptops and desktops, that some of the enterprise software has an incredibly long tail. I know that SAP still has customers running. I think they've still got some R3 customers. And R3 went out of the sales picture in the mid-90s. For SAP. So they've still got a lot of R4 customers. They've got some R3, and I believe at the last Sapphire, I was talking to an SAP executive where he said that they only recently got their last customers off of R1 and R2, and those were their original mainframe packages.
Wow.
So these things have very long tails. A lot of companies, once they get their back-end systems working the way they want them to work, don't touch them. And it's part of their strategy not to touch them. So it's going to be a long time before we get to everyone in the world is running everything on the cloud, assuming that ever happens. And I think a lot of these software companies do a very delicate dance along this knife edge of seeing that new customers are, in fact, very interested in the cloud offerings, wanting to make sure they can capture that while not being so heavily bent in that direction that they alienate and lose these very lucrative legacy customers. I think I'm glad I'm not on the marketing team for a lot of these companies because it has to be a really difficult job trying to walk on, you know, both sides of that line successfully and simultaneously.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I can kind of understand this is a quick analogy, but from my own perspective, whenever I see those automatic update messages, I always click on do it later. Because if it's not broke, I don't want to fix it. And it's going to delay everything else I'm working on. And certainly it must take a while for customers to digest the idea of paying more money for on-premises systems and of the disruption that comes from migration and updates and upgrades. Do you have the same experience, Kurt?
You know I do. I've got to admit that for my mobile devices, I tend to let them update overnight. For my laptop, my main workstation, I'm very fortunate because I use the same platform on my home system or my personal system and my business system. And in general, because I keep all of my work files in the cloud, if one of them is going to update, I can just switch over and work on the other one while the update process is going on. But for people who have a single system, it is indeed a big deal to try and figure out how to update in the middle of a workday.
Indeed. I think you know, they're sort of working on that technology now to make it easier and updates in place. But still, it's a disruptive process whenever these major updates, particularly for the on-premises systems, happen.
You know, it's interesting. A member of our audience just sent me an instant message that talked about security updates when the update later could be a very, you know, problematic strategy if we're talking about something that protects against zero-day vulnerabilities and things like that. And it strikes me that this is the sort of thing where companies that update their entire fleet at once, who push out updates to their entire fleet, you know, they really have to put in some long hours to go ahead and validate that update, make sure it's not going to break any of their existing enterprise applications before they can push it out to the field. And when you know that there's a genuine vulnerability out there just waiting to be exploited on your company's computers, that's got to be something of a nerve-wracking time between the point when you know that a fix exists and when you know it's safe to apply that fix to your fleet of workstations.
That's such a great point. I imagine that's got to be a tough job to be the decision maker on that and be the one held accountable for either making that call to go forward with an update and then something breaking, or making the call not to, and then having a flaw, a security vulnerability that is not patched. It's a tough job to be in IT.
It is, and you know, this does bring up one of the key differences between on-prem applications and those that are delivered via the cloud. One of the things we assume that happens in the cloud is that security updates, feature upgrades, all of those things happen automatically. That's one of the selling points of the cloud, that the cloud provider takes care of making sure all of that works and that it's all pushed out to all their customers simultaneously. That's a great thing, but what if you have heavily customized that cloud-delivered software, or you have used a piece of that cloud infrastructure in a larger and much more complex enterprise application? Well, then all of a sudden, a regular update that is pushed to all the customers could conceivably break part of your application. And in that instance, perhaps that wonderful feature of the cloud becomes a bug of the highest order. You know, we tend to, in too many occasions, look at all of these issues through our own lens. And for most of us, the lens that we're using is the lens of someone who is running one or two laptop or desktop computers and a small fleet of portable devices. But it really is, you know, when you get to the enterprise, it's not just a question of running a larger machine or running more machines. The complexity really does increase exponentially, and there are fewer and fewer simple answers out there. I have to say that this is one of those cases where the cloud has to be used very judiciously, and in fairness, most enterprise IT shops do so. But it's just an example of where those of us standing on the sidelines, those of us observing, can come out with some very quick answers when a quick answer is the last thing that's truly available to these IT professionals in the enterprise.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know that in talking to customers of SaaS-based systems, one customer in particular was talking about the other problem of vendor lock-in as well. When he based much of his business, built all his reports on a particular vendor's software, and then that vendor turned around and raised prices in a significant way. This was not a huge customer, and so they didn't have a lot of pull to push back on these price increases. So they basically had to decide, do we migrate our entire system and all our development work to something else, or do we pay the price for this new version of this cloud-based software? I'm not sure what they did. I did not follow up with this particular customer. This was a little while back, but it really put them in the corner about what to do.
You know, vendor lock-in is.
Yeah.
I was going to say, vendor lock-in is one of those topics that get a bunch of CIOs and IT professionals in a room, and they can just go for hours on this question. Because on the one hand, there can be some real financial incentives to be what amounts to a single vendor shop. And in the parlance of the executive suite, it does give you one throat to choke, one call to make if something goes horribly wrong. On the other hand, as you point out, if you go just a little too far, it can actually reduce your leverage with that vendor because they know what it would cost you to change. So again, this is one of those where there are opinions across the spectrum and instances taken from real life to back up pretty much any one of those opinions you want to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of hard choices out there. I'm glad I'm not the person making the decision about some of these plans going forward. And I can certainly see the case for organizations wanting to keep their on-premises systems because of that and buy the software licenses and keep them for a number of years and control the updates because of those reasons. Although you don't get the same benefits, and you need to also have more IT staff to help manage and support users when you're sticking with the on-premises solutions.
It is a tangled knot of issues, and a good thing for us because it gives us plenty to write about and talk about on a regular basis. So I'm
that's
all in favor of this mass confusion just from a purely personal standpoint. And speaking of mass confusion, I want to change our focus a little bit because another story that you wrote this week was about a vendor in an area that is still just new enough where there's plenty of confusion, and that's in the data warehouse market. You wrote an article about the Snowflake Cloud Data Warehouse. Now, this was an update, but tell me about it. What's going on, and why do so many people care about Snowflake computing in the data warehouse field?
So this was pretty interesting to me because a lot of the data warehouse solutions were created for on-premises, and Snowflake Computing created to be deployed in the cloud. It is currently hosted on Amazon on AWS, and it was built. It was built as a data warehouse if you were building one today from scratch, which is basically what happened. It's built to ingest a number of different data types, big data, unstructured data. We're talking about Hadoop and other forms of unstructured data, as well as the more traditional types. And it let database administrators work with their familiar SQL to query the data. And so it's provided a more modern way to approach the data warehouse. And it also provides the elasticity of the cloud so that it can scale according to what organizations need at the time. The thing about big data is that it's big, but we still have to pay for that bigness. The really interesting architectural difference about Snowflake is that it separates the pricing for the compute from the pricing for the storage, from the pricing for the analytics on top of the queries that are being done, so that customers can pay for what they use, and that has made it more cost-effective for some customers out there, including the customer I spoke with, which is Blackboard, which is an educational service provider, providing like the platform for curriculum, and they've also expanded into many other services for educational institutions. But they are using it to they're using Snowflake to provide predictive analytics on student attrition and discover what students are at risk for dropping out, so they can address those issues if they are alerted that a student may be at risk, which is a costly problem for universities.
No question. Now Snowflake is a company that has some fairly heavy hitters in its executive core. It hasn't been around for years and years. It's a relatively new company, but it's got a bunch of high-level expertise inside. When you talk to people, is the company relying heavily on those names to help get it in the door at customers?
You know, I don't know if it is. I would expect that would be the case, because we're talking about people who have been around in the database industry for years and years, former executives from Oracle. We're talking about Bob Muglia from formerly of Microsoft. So these are real big heavy hitters out there in the industry who have relationships in the industry. And I certainly would expect that those are names that would open doors for this company. Like you said, the company itself has only had its product or service on the market for about a year and has only been around for about 4 years. But they do have about 200 customers, contracted customers, in a range of sizes, from small to large.
And in a market where they're playing with customers of the size they are, 200 is not a bad number. Again, from the consumer side, you would expect to see hundreds of thousands or millions. But in this big data market, a couple hundred customers is not a bad number at all.
Especially for just a year out of the gate, really. That's pretty impressive, I think.
Now, another thing I've got to ask on this model that they've got going about basically the a la carte model, where you pay only for what you use. From what you're seeing, is that a model that the enterprise is moving to? Because when I hear about it, again, I tend to think of discount airlines, where they start, well, you your basic we'll charge you $15 for a seat, but if you want to use a seat belt, there's an additional charge, and if you want to actually breathe the air, we've got the air charge, and all of these things. is this a la carte pricing being accepted more gracefully in the enterprise market than it is in the traveling consumer market?
Well, I think I'm not sure about the enterprise market overall, but I can tell you that for data and big data in particular, it kind of makes sense because there is so much data being generated. If you had to buy if you had to buy a prescribed amount of compute to go along with the with the amount of data that you wanted to buy, it might not be as cost effective for you to be able to keep all the data that you want to query. But for big data in particular, I mean, I spoke with someone from doing cancer research looking at the big data around the human genome and around cancer genomes, and that's an enormous amount of data, that terabytes and terabytes of data. And this person said that big data, I think it was something like the costs of storage in big data is getting close to outpacing Moore's law. I forget exactly how he put it, but it was dead on point. It's getting expensive, and big data is huge. So when you decouple the expense of the compute from that, it can make it much more cost effective. And that was one of the driving factors behind why Blackboard chose Snowflake instead of solutions from AWS, or they might have looked at Microsoft's cloud as well. I can't, one other cloud they looked at, but that was one of the reasons they went with Snowflake instead, was that pricing strategy, which was actually a benefit to them and not kind of the nickel and diming that you see at discount airlines.
Well, Jessica, it sounds like we've got a lot more to cover here. Unfortunately, we don't have any more time. We bought just enough time for the show, and here we are at the end of it. I appreciate you being my guest today. This has been great, and I will look forward to the next time you can be on. We hope that things get to a point where you can be a regular guest here on Information Week Live, but until that point, can you tell us what you've got your eye on, what our listeners can look for under your byline for the coming week?
Yeah, so I'm working on a couple of things. One is a look at a real estate service provider who's using data visualization in new ways to help customers get more productivity out of their workforces and improve maintenance of facilities and all kinds of stuff like that. And I'm also working on a slideshow that looks at alternatives for recruiting data science talent. As we all know, there's a lot of demand out there and not a lot of supply. And so I spoke with a few data scientists and an executive recruiter, and we'll be providing some quick hit advice on that.
We will look forward to that. And if people want to keep up with you on social media, where can they find you in the Tweety Pipes or on other social media?
Yeah, the best place for me is Twitter, and it's at Jessica Davis, no spaces, just one word. And
just
what about
one
you,
word? Well,
you
what
have,
about me?
You have a very cool Twitter handle.
Well, yes, it is a handle that shows that I'm a geek in several directions. My Twitter handle is at KG4GWA, which happens to be my amateur radio call sign. It's been that same call sign for a long time, and the Federal Communications Commission makes sure that it is unique to me. So there was no question of asking whether I could get that as my Twitter handle. people I hope will follow me because, well, coming up probably sometime this weekend, I've got a piece on some keys to Internet of Things development success. If you want to launch an IoT development process, here are some things you really want to make sure you think about before you get too far down the road. And I've also got some really interesting user stories coming up. One is the Internet of Agricultural Things, the way that agriculture is using connected machines and connected devices to grow our food and our agricultural processes more effectively and more efficiently. And it includes things like mesh networks that cover large wheat fields and things of that nature. That's coming up. Also have a neat story about the IT infrastructure of the Bergen County, New Jersey Sheriff's Department, how they went to a hyper-converged architecture for part of their application stack, and they're now expanding that because they've enjoyed the success it's brought. So lots of interesting stories coming up, lots of things to keep up with, and with the new month that is almost here, want to let our listeners know that there are going to be some new things coming up at Information Week and here on Information Week's radio component, because we are tying ourselves a little bit more closely to a conference that is owned by our parent company, UBM. The conference is Interop. Now, if you've been following our radio products for a long time, you know that we do every year Interop Radio. Well, Interop Radio is going to come back in August, because Interop Radio is going to be going year-round. So lots of great new things happening there. We'll have new hosts, new areas to talk about. So that's happening. In addition to Information Week Live continuing, we've just got a bunch of interesting stuff going on, and I think it's going to be great for our readers and listeners and for the new readers and listeners who I think will find us and find us useful as we move forward. Well, Jessica Davis, Senior Editor at Information Week, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much for having me again, Kurt. I appreciate it. My pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Look for us online. Look for us next week. And until then, so long. Thanks for listening.